91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. It's a usual measure of one's worth to consider our assets as rugged individuals, but does science concur? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll visit with Dr. Amy Banks, a practicing psychiatrist whose field of study is relational neuroscience. She says our close relationships are at least as important as individual traits. She's the author of Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. Why do so many wind up in the same type of detrimental relationship? Perhaps standing on our own isn't so beneficial. That's next, after NPR and regional news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon.
Joe, did you know that this is Healthy Relationships Week?
How would I know that? You caught me blindsided there, Bonnie. Well, rugged individuals are celebrated in history, perhaps even more so in today's culture. We say strong and vibrant men and women who choose and explore their own paths will be happier and more fulfilled. But does that maxim hold up scientifically? This hour, we visit with Dr. Amy Banks.
She's the Director of Advanced Training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women. Her book is Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. Excuse me, and she joins us from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Dr. Baker. Banks?
Dr. Banks. Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Well, I have to tell you, the first three words of your book stop me in my tracks. Boundaries are overrated. For decades, for generations, we've been told about and instructed by the experts in the importance of the establishment of strong boundaries. So let me ask you, are we talking about the same thing here, or is it a case of how we're defining what boundaries are?
Well, a little of both. What I would say is that idea of boundaries, the way that they are usually used, I think, in our, you know, whether it's our mental health system or, you know, self-help gurus, that sort of thing, the way that it is usually used is in support of the separate self, right? That person who can stand on their own, who doesn't let people get to them, who doesn't, you know, isn't impacted by things. And I think that sort of wall boundary is a myth, basically.
Well, but it's not just that. It's also for people who allow people to encroach on their space in a way that can be destructive or abusive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't want to say, oh, absolutely throw all the boundaries out. But if you really see what that does is it then does not see the relationship as sort of the issue, and that by being able to build, you know, in the book I talk about build stronger pathways for connection, mm-hmm. actually that idea of a boundary sort of transforms itself into a more of an interface or more of a porous surface of connection between two people. And so I don't by any means want to be saying that if somebody's abusing you or, you know, that's just okay. That relationship, if somebody's abusing you, is not one that you want impacting you, for sure.
You speak of psychological maturity in the book. How do we gain that?
Well, the way we gain it is in healthy relationships. So, again, that idea that, you know, kind of we're born dependent in sort of what we need to do, what society does is teach us how to be, quote, independent, and that we have to separate from people, that we have to individuate, I think is really a myth, and it's one that, in my opinion, really undermines our natural capacity to grow within the context of relationships. So I really think the measure of maturity is that you go from that sort of dependency as a you know, an infant, which, you know, even in that state we have more kind of back and forth between mother and infant than, or caretaker than in infant than once was thought, but that we grow really towards increased levels of interdependency and mutuality and a healthy relationship, so that we need people every single bit as much as we did when we were in the crib. It may look different, but we absolutely need them.
So I, just to clarify, we're not just talking about romantic relationships now. We're talking
Absolutely
about relationships
not.
Of any kind, including familial,
yeah.
friendships, colleagues, any relationship.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. We are really talking about relationships across the board. Yeah. Relationships at work. You know, we are a kind of pack animal, if you will, and we need to be in that pack. Right, we need to be interacting. We need to be stimulating, literally, these pathways for connection regularly in order to be healthy and centered and grounded.
So our brains were designed for relationships,
That's right.
Just as other primates.
Exactly. That's right. And ironically, those very same brains have created a culture that sort of downplays them and put them as a kind of a back seat. You know, in order to just bolster the separate self, right? You might be able to get a few of the goodies that you need to stand on your own, but not that we are specifically intermingled kind of every moment with relationships.
You cite a pretty fascinating finding by this neurophysicist that was actually, the finding was incidental to the research that was being conducted
yes.
with monkeys in Italy. Tell us about that.
That is work that was done by researchers in Italy, actually, and what they were doing, they weren't looking. It's the beginning of what's called the mirror neuron system that sort of unfolded over the last about 15 years, and what they were looking for, these researchers, had nothing to do with how people read other people. It had to do with this particular area of a monkey's brain that measures their ability to reach out and grab something. It was F5, so named. And what they noticed one day in the lab is that when another monkey was watching, or even when a human being was actually across the room reaching for something, the monkey that was hooked up to this measuring device, that area of their brain was activated even though they weren't reaching. Can you follow that?
So, sure.
Yeah, so the monkey's just watching somebody, and the person is reaching, and that area activates in their brain. And what that really baffling finding led to is this whole series of research on how we literally read another person's actions, intentions, and emotions, and that we do it by mimicking in our nervous system what they're doing. So we have this neurological template of what they're doing that is like we're doing it too. And that's kind of that intuitive sense of knowing that we have other people.
So what are some of the other techniques for this relational neuroscience research? I suppose then you're talking about a lot of fMRIs.
Say that again? Sorry.
You used a lot of fMRIs in this research?
Yes. Yeah, functional imaging. I mean, so what's allowed this research to come about is actually the new technology in imaging, where you can actually watch the brain and see what areas are activated while somebody's doing something. So it's less like a snapshot, a photo snapshot, and more like a video.
So what are some of the implications of mirroring in lives?
Yeah. So what are the implications of mirroring, right? Why does that matter?
Mm-hmm.
So because we operate in essentially a cooperative society, right, whether it's at work or at home, trying to get things done, the ability to accurately read what another person is feeling, doing, their intention is really critical, right? So, and to be able to do it really in a split second. And I think, you go back to that old, not so old, but a little bit old notion of emotional intelligence, right? The ability to read other people and is really critical to productivity, to getting things done, to raising children as parents, I mean, it's really, it's kind of everywhere.
So we're not talking, we're talking about mirroring. We're not talking about empathy now. We're talking,
So empathy is a version of mirroring, right? So when we are having an empathic response and we're with somebody else, the mirror neurons, that circuit that happens to be involved in our affective system is activated. So yes, we are talking about that. So okay. When you're reading or getting other people, if you will, right, there's a part of the getting that's about, oh, he's walking in this direction, whereas he's headed probably here, but there's also the getting that's about the emotional getting. And, you know, so when people have an empathic response, their affective system or their feeling centers, if you will, actually activate as well, similar to what the other person has. And there's that profound joining in those empathic moments.
What is exactly relational neuroscience? Is this actually a new field? Because you say
well,
you call it that.
Relational neuroscience is I think of it as a application of a wide body of research called interpersonal neurobiology that's been done over the last 20 years by Dan Siegel, Alan Shure, a bunch of researchers, but that have really looked on many different levels, scientific levels, from anthropology to neuroscience, to look at the interpersonal biology. And what this does is it really applies it, relational neuroscience. So in the book, I outline, you know, sort of four really key pathways for connection, neural pathways for connection. And it's the idea that you can know them, you know, you can know them, you can feel them, you can identify them in yourself, and that those pathways, you want to be nice and strong and robust in order to be able to form healthy relationships. But the the flip side is you need to be in healthy relationships in order for those to be sort of strong and robust. Mm. So sort of taking that feedback loop,
right,
between relationship and your pathways for connection and really making it stronger.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about what is a healthy relationship. We're speaking with Dr. Amy Banks. She's a psychiatrist and director of advanced training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women. She's the co-author of Four Ways to Click. We'll be right back.
And it is Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dr. Amy Banks. We're talking about her book, Four Ways to Click. And Bonnie mentioned she wanted to direct our conversation into the realm of what is a healthy relationship. Is that correct, Bonnie?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct.
So, what is a healthy relationship? I go back to some wisdom that a teacher of mine, Jean Baker Miller, came up with a good 30 years ago. And what she did is she focused on, I mean, it's hard, right? Because on the one hand, when you're in a good relationship, you kind of feel that you're in a good relationship, right? And what she did is she talked about a growth-fostering relationship and what are the signs that you're in a growth-fostering relationship, one, you know, essentially that you can grow and the other person can grow. And she talked about five things. And I would have people, you know, kind of try on a relationship that they've been in to see if this resonates with them. So the first thing is that when you're in a healthy relationship, usually what you have is a sense of zest or energy, kind of that kind of zip that you get when you're with that person. And again, it can be working on a project in the office, it can be with a friend, it can be with a partner. So a sense of energy, a sense of clarity about yourself, the other person, and in fact the relationship, right? So in a healthy relationship, it's not getting all fuzzy, it's not getting all blurred like whose feelings are whom. There's really a sense of clarity. Okay, this is who I am, this is who this person is. A sense of clarity.
Stop you there, it's interesting because what you're talking about there is exactly what we started with, was when you said that it's not blurred. Usually we think about boundaries being blurred in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
right? So yeah. Again, we're back to boundaries, but you're saying in this case, a person needs to know who they are and who the other person is, and
that's
the separation.
Right. Exactly. So imagine, rather than a big wall that goes up to set a boundary, there actually is respect and an honest desire on both people's parts to see the other person clearly,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, that in an ideal is what we're talking about, not the boundary of, you know, keeping you out,
mm-hmm.
right? And so by that marker, obviously, if there's somebody that keeps really oozing into your space and, you know, mucking things up, that's kind of by definition not going to be a healthy relationship.
Okay.
Right? So I said the energy or zest, the clarity, the ability to act. So, and this is key. So the ability to act in a relationship when it's healthy. And action can be, okay, this relationship gives me more energy to act at work, on a project, out in the world, but also within the relationship, so that if somebody's making you angry, you say to them, okay, you're really making me angry. So it's a, you know, there can be action towards resolving conflict. So the ability to act. More value for yourself. When you're in a healthy relationship, you feel valued just by being in the relationship, right? You value yourself. And then finally, an increased sense of wanting to be in other relationships. So those are the sort of five good things that people talk about, or Jean talked about anyway, in a growth-fostering relationship.
Well,
why have we historically embraced the lone eagle, so to speak, the Ayn Rand and heroic individualism, if that's really counter to the way our brains are wired?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a great question. You know, where did that culturally kind of take hold? You know, how far back did it go, and how is it being kind of perpetuated now? And, you know, I can't exactly tell you how far back, although I do live in Lexington, Mass., kind of the seat of the first separation. But, I mean, it does go hand in hand with, you know, the competitive spirit, the hyper-competitiveness. There's a whole bunch of research now that talks about that actually people that cooperate are more successful than people that succeed, right? So it's almost like it's head ahead of steam, and, you know, it keeps getting built, this mythology of the separate self.
Well, what about for those individuals who are artists and by necessity live solitary mm-hmm. lives? Are they going against their nature?
No. You know, so what I would say is there's a huge difference between being lonely and being alone, right? So I think there are a lot of people, and sometimes you'd call them introverts, or, you know, I think people in the creative arts, you know, can spend lots of time alone. But the question is, are they so lonely that it's a distressing, stressful experience, right?
Okay.
Now, certainly some artists are going to say, yes, and I need that angst to be able to do my art.
Mm-hmm.
But there also are a lot of people that are doing creative projects, spending a lot of time alone, but they have enough interaction with other people that those pathways are actually, you know, kind of kept up. And in fact, what happens is, you know, I think one of the things I talk about is the relationships end up living in you, is that your whole neurophysiology gets tied into your relational world, so you don't have to be side by side with the person to be able to kind of get the benefit of the relationship.
Well, let's involve our listeners. Do you have healthy relationships, or do you repeat unhealthy relationships? Or maybe you feel independent and feel that you don't need relationships, or maybe you feel that you do need a partner to complete you. You can call us
1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and you can shoot Bonnie an email, radio@WLRN.org, if you're a little shy.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about these four neural pathways.
Sure.
Tell us about them briefly. I'm assuming some of us have stronger ones, some of us have
weaker
exactly. ones.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the book really talks about how you can assess those. But I'll go through them very quickly. Number one, they are, the acronym I use is the CARE program, and C-A-R-E stands for each of them. C is a sense of calm that you feel when your smart vagus nerve is stimulated. That is a nerve that's part of your autonomic nervous system, just like your sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system. And, you know, those pathways are well known to be responsible for fight or flight, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic for freeze. But the smart vagus is responsible for relationships. And so when you're in healthy relationships, it innervates your facial expressions, your eyes. You lighten up, you brighten up, you smile, you lift your eyes, you hear more intensely. And, in fact, that feeds into your sympathetic nervous system and says you can calm down. So calm from the smart vagus nerve.
Okay.
A is a sense of acceptedness that you have when you're in a rich relationship network. And this is based on research that shows that there's an area of your brain that lights up when you're socially rejected, so teased, bullied, ostracized, and it's this, it lights up, is activated, and it's a pain pathway, and it's the exact same pathway that lights up for the distress of physical illness or injury. To the human being accepted is as important as being, you know, free from illness and injury.
Okay.
Exact same thing. R is the resonance system that we just talked about, the mirror neurons, and then finally, E is the dopamine reward system, or energy, and that's the energy you get in healthy relationships, and it's connected to the dopamine reward system. Most people think about that as related to addictions, and in fact, for many of us, it's been paired to, as we take relationships out of the equation of how to get dopamine, we turn to other ways to get our dopamine, right? Because we want to be feeling better in some ways, but actually being healthfully connected in relationships is gives you a ready supply of dopamine that provides energy and motivation.
What about people who are unhappy unless they're with people all the time? Is that going off the other way too far?
Or? Sure. So the question, I think the question is, you know, people that are in kind of, there's this term codependent, right? They have to be with people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what those relationships look like, right? If those are healthy relationships, I actually wouldn't worry about it. I think that if they are able to be with people, good, if they're healthy relationships. If, in fact, they're reaching out and they're trying to be with people that are then kind of sick of them or, you know, not treating them well, then you may be, in fact, just perpetuating a feedback loop of stress into their system, right? So they're kind of chronically seeking healthy relationship, but there may not be healthy relationship out there that they're connecting with, right? So they keep looking, keep trying to you know, and it gets a little desperate.
And they keep repeating a pattern of recurring unhealthy
right.
relationships.
Exactly.
So how does your work, or how would our work, strengthening these neural pathways prevent us from picking the wrong relationship?
Well, part of the book also includes something I call the relational assessment. And what you're going to do is look at, just as I said, the feedback loop is, okay, these are the relationships in my life currently, and this is how they're shaping these pathways, right? And then this is how my pathways are going to lead to my choosing certain people. So there's an assessment that literally allows you to go through, identify the people that are kind of taking up the most relational time in your life, and that's not just the good relationships. You might have a boss that's really, you know, grouchy and, you know, nasty or whatever, and if you're spending a lot of time in that, then that relationship is going to shape these pathways, right? It's going to make them all a little bit weaker. So you go through the assessment, there's a 20-question assessment for each relationship, and you're going to actually see the quality. I sort of think about it as sort of making your relational world kind of pop up in 3D, you know, you'll all of a sudden have a clearer sense of how the people in your life are shaping these pathways. At the same time, from this assessment, you actually can get a snapshot picture of how these pathways are doing. Do you have trouble kind of getting people or being, you know, kind of gotten by the resonant system? Is that a little weaker? Are you chronically feeling sort of a lack of acceptance? You know, and so you can sort of see how those pathways are functioning And then what ultimately what you do is you take that information, and I have some exercises you can do to actually improve them and ultimately improve your relationships and the choices you make.
Do these neural pathways depend on genetics or upbringing?
So certainly there's going to be some genetics, right? Because when you, particularly like the smart vagus that I talked about, that autonomic nervous system, the smart vagus, sympathetic and parasympathetic, you may be genetically loaded to have a lot of kind of anxiety and a stress response, right?
Right.
That certainly can be in your genetics. At the same time, you know, you may have been raised in an environment that was difficult or, you know, in an environment maybe where there's war or extreme poverty and violence or even frank abuse at the home, and that's going to shape this whole smart vagus autonomic nervous system towards stress, right? Certainly, the relationships that you have growing up leave a huge footprint on your capacity to connect and on these neural pathways.
Okay, another break. We're speaking with Dr. Amy Banks on today's Topical Currents. She's written Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. We have calls, and we'll get to those when we get back.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December. I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock.
Isn't that the original sense of irony?
Of course, that's Simon and Garfunkel. I am a rock. Thank you, Michael Stock and Joe, for that. So, Dr. Banks, what about people who have a strong sense of self and feel complete within themselves, and they make that distinction? They don't need relationships, but they choose them or want them. Is that different too?
I guess I would wonder, when they say a complete sense of themselves, what they actually mean by that. What does that look like?
Well, just that, you know, we've always been taught that neediness is not a good thing, and that needing somebody to complete us is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. Is that another myth?
You know, I guess I struggle with the word complete.
Okay. Okay.
It ends up sounding so final.
Right. Right.
I think, you know, part of the message here is that we are co-creating each other all the time. I don't think there tends not to be an endpoint. That's one of the messages of neuroscience and neuroplasticity, is the brain. All these pathways for connection are literally changing minute to minute. I think the myth is that we, you know, get to some place of total completeness. Now, if you want to say to me, geez, I know a woman who is, she's not interested in sort of getting married or, you know, having a primary love relationship, but, you know, I have to say, I don't know anybody who is really alone, isolated, and happy, you know, whether it's, you know, and it may be, you know, it may be somebody that has a pretty good friendship network or really loves the work and has some colleagues or, you know what I mean? But
right,
this idea
right.
that we're somehow totally complete and don't need somebody, I think, is really a myth.
Let's take a call or two from our listeners. This is Adrian in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me. I actually had a question about introverts. I don't know if you already got to this topic, but I've felt my whole life that I haven't needed as much contact with people. as those people may have had with me, to feel kind of fulfilled. But I just wanted to see how, if you could explain the difference between, I guess, the so-called introverts and extroverts.
Sure.
If it means anything, I am an INTP in the Myers-Briggs test. I don't know if that's an actual, like, science, or if it's just pseudoscience, or if it's just fun. But
what is
that,
say that again? What is that, Adrian? You're a what?
I am an INTP in the Myers-Briggs personality test.
Uh-huh. Okay, so Dr. Banks, let's start there. What's an INTP?
So it's I is introvert. What is the N, Adrian?
I'm sorry?
So go through the letters. I know I is an introvert.
Yes. N is, I forgot what N is now, but T is thinking and P is perceptive.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, intuitive.
So,
N is intuitive.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Myers-Briggs is a standard kind of personality test that has been around for years and years, and it sort of typecasts people in categories, and actually most people find them to be quite simpatico with how they feel about themselves. So what I would say about introverts is this, that there certainly is a wide difference in the amount of time people actually spend face-to-face with other people. And I think for introverts, and it may be part of the perception, part of the sensations, that tends to be lower. And what I've said before is, for an introvert, it's not that you don't have the neural pathways for connection, right? You just don't need them stimulated as often to keep them up. So most introverts that I know aren't isolationists, right? They just need,
right,
they need a little more time on their own to recharge before going kind of back out into social situations. So it's not that these pathways are weakened, right? In some ways, you're able to hold on to kind of a sense of being connected even while being kind of on your own.
Yep.
Does that feel like it fits at all?
Yeah, I feel like that explains it perfectly, actually. It at least it explains my personal situation.
Yeah. And I think I think that... when you just take people into introverts and extroverts, the dividing point seems to be introverts don't like relationships, extroverts do, and I think that's way too black and white. I think everyone needs relationships, and introverts need a little more kind of recharge time.
Okay.
Thanks, Adrian.
Okay, Adrian, thank you very much for your call, and we'll take another. Bonnie, we'll go to Janet. Bonnie, I feel a little bit like Dr. Fraser Crane here. Janet in Miami, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead, sorry.
I just wanted to comment on the transition between someone who was originally very used to solitude myself, and it really had to do with my art making, because I thought it was a way to facilitate self-reflection and self-worth and try to really understand yourself. So I was actually the type of person you were describing, where I was more interested in not having a relationship and making sure that I focused on the self. And then suddenly it was a transition into a very healthy relationship, which is when I realized that at some point it takes another person for you to learn more about yourself and for you to really grow as a person. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a really big fan of the idea that it takes actually being in the world around you to grow as a person versus being in isolation. And just wanted to comment in general about the good things that can happen when you're actually in a relationship such as that.
Yeah, Janet, I love that. When your choice is I can be alone or in a bad relationship, a lot of people pick alone, right? But when the choice includes then a good relationship or a healthy relationship, that's a whole different kettle of fish, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it can add to your life and your growth in ways that if you haven't had that, you don't know.
Yes, that's exactly how it happened.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
We'll move along. Next caller, our number 1-800-743-9576. Next caller is Kathy in Miami. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I am I'm a divorcee and a very reluctant one, and I just wondered how to help people in my situation who are with a spouse who is so busy in their own life with multiple careers that there's no time in their life for a relationship. And I tried for years to draw that person out and to make a life together with this person, because that's why I married this person. And so ultimately, I just want to be able to help other people achieve a good married relationship, because these days it's really tough to do.
Yeah. I'm not sure I heard the question in that. I certainly hear the pain in that, that, you know, sometimes people find themselves kind of honestly in relationships that started probably as a very loving relationship, but then other things take up much more time, and there isn't any time to focus on the relationship.
Yeah, how do you make that other person see that, you know, they have to give something up in order to make time for that relationship? What is a good way to give that person?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And in the long run, I don't think you can make that person see that. You know, one of the things I do like about the neuroscience is the very clear knowledge that when you are engaged in healthy relationship, you actually are both healthier physically and you live longer. And, you know, there is a way that I think for people who are so distracted by whether it's climbing the corporate ladder or, you know, focusing solely on career, that they can sometimes hear this information and it will allow them to pause, right? Most people that are that kind of caught up in the cycle of, sounds like probably overwork, you know, are sort of getting their, I would say getting their dopamine and their stress response chronically stimulated with that. And that's very hard to break. Mm-hmm. They have to see a good reason for it. For some people that will be, you know, maybe a threat to leave, maybe, oh my gosh, I may not, you know, if the marriage breaks up, I don't see my kids. I mean, there, you know, but you do have to find some hook.
Might be a good idea to hand them a copy of your book.
There you go. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. We're speaking with Dr. Amy Banks. She is Director of Advanced Training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women and the author of Four Ways to Click. We'll be right back.
Minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical current. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Amy Banks. She's the Director of Advanced Training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women. And we're talking about her book, Four Ways to Click. We'll have links to that on our website and also the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tell me, Dr. Banks, your theory of relationships, how would it relate to raising children?
Raising children. You know, we talked earlier in the show about how, you know, those early attachment relationships, those early child-rearing relationships really are so crucial, because a child's learning machinery, if you will, is just turned on all the time. So all of the things that they're experiencing just kind of gets in there and shifts and changes them. And, you know, I think to be able to begin to teach kids healthy relationship skills is absolutely crucial to change, I think, the cultural conversations that we're having.
Does the digital world affect this now?
Well, I think the digital world affects us in this way, which is certainly there's people kind of default to that rather than a conversation. They'll default to the text or what have you. At the same time, our children, if you think about it, they go to school, you know, so many hours a week, and they are engaged in projects. There's plenty of time for them to be interacting with other kids, with teachers, with, you know, And in all of those interactions, those pathways are being stimulated. either in a positive way or a negative way, right? So if a kid's being left out or chronically, you know, not chosen on the playground for something or being ostracized, then we know their pain pathways are literally being stimulated over and over again. And we wouldn't tolerate a kid being just hit over and over again, but we do seem to tolerate a certain amount of ostracism. You know, so I think it's particularly crucial that this is kind of implemented in being taught in the, at the school level, if not sooner.
Well, there is so much now about anti-bullying, you know, that is being taught, and there are movements afoot for that.
Yeah.
But are the connections you're talking about, are they only face-to-face, or can they be virtual? I mean,
no, they can be virtual. You know, there's a lot of virtual, a lot of virtual contact that actually is quite fabulous, right? You know, what I would say is sort of the more closely the technology simulates a one-to-one, you know, a one-to-one arrangement, the more sensations that you're going to get and the more those pathways are stimulated. But still, I mean, one of the things I talk about even for the smart vagus nerve is, you know, if you want to strengthen that, one of the things, one of the very simple things you can do is, you know, I see kids doing selfies all the time, and they take a picture or their friends will send them a quick picture. And in the context of a healthy relationship where the child actually knows that person and is already positively connected, that is like just a quick stimulation of that pathway, right? You know, usually what you'll see kids, they smile, they giggle, they laugh. That stimulates the smart vagus, and it will feed back into their stress response and help them feel calmer. So there are lots of ways that we can use the technology that is pro-relationship.
Okay.
And back to our calls. This is Ralph in Fort Lauderdale.
Yes. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Okay. First-time caller, always a listener. Ms. Banks, I want to ask you something. I don't want to make this too long because I know it's going to be a long session.
Sure.
Want to know, okay, if I was previously in a relationship, got divorced, happy divorce, actually.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm in another relationship where there's a woman, she tends to feel like every little thing I'm doing is called flirtation. I'm like, can I be myself and just talk to people? Or should I respect the fact that it's just me? I'm just an extrovert, I guess, instead of an invert.
Yeah, and the question is, which side do we come down on, or?
Yeah, because I feel like I don't like to be controlled in the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I know my place, don't tell me what I need to do. But if someone decides they want to conversate, I'll conversate with a man or a woman.
Yeah. So that, you know, what I would say is, it sounds like the two of you aren't matching at all in terms of you being out to just being out in the world and interacting with other people, that somehow threatens her.
Mm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so I would imagine it threatens her, then it, you know, it kicks off her stress response system rather than anything that's about these pathways for connection, right? And so, you know, the question is how to come to a common understanding of what's going on. And it sounds like, you know, it sounds like she does probably could use some work settling her sympathetic nervous system down a little, right?
Okay. All right.
You know, and at the same time, I mean, the question is, you know, what do you do with her request, right? Does it make you so angry that then you're operating out of that place of stress rather than
out of that stress, exactly, because I'm like, you know, I'm not throwing my phone number or, you know, being getting crazy, like, you know, I want to be with this woman, but it's just
right. And that's, I think that's a dynamic that gets going with a lot of people who feel, you know, who basically feel quite insecure in the relationships, right? And, you know, again, that would be, you know, in my reading and the way I tend to think of things, there probably is some real imbalance or things that both of you could work on these pathways for connection to work on trusting each other, literally. And there are exercises that you can do that I lay out in the book that can help you do that.
Okay.
Okay, Ralph. Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we're short on time, but let's go to Doug in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, great show as usual. My issue is this. I'm 57 years old, divorced. I wasn't married that long, but I've been in many long-term relationships. I find as time goes on, you know, the changing of mentality towards relationships and marriage, I see more and more women are the ones that don't want to be in a relationship, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. It's kind of almost like there's been a shift in, you know, in you know, thought processes of being with somebody, and, you know, if they... Yeah. I'm not even talking about marriage. I'm just talking about just being a, like almost like a free spirit type of of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Bangs?
Yeah, you know, my, what I would say about that is I think it's probably an astute observation. What I hear from a lot of women, particularly if they've been married and married, raised kids, there has been such a lot of output, right, towards giving, 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 that sometimes when they get onto this other side, they're sort of like, okay, finally me. I can actually spend some time focusing on me. And the worry is they get into another relationship and they're just focusing on that other person. And to that I would say, you know, it's about working on relationships that actually allow that woman to have some, you know, clarity about herself, like we talked about earlier, right? And the so it's often a default position that comes from, you know, okay, I've been giving now for 30 years.
Dr. Bangs, you have a private practice and you specialize in relational psychopharmacology and therapy. What is relational psychopharmacology? Is that just treating it with medications?
That... No, you know, what relational psychopharmacology is actually doing medication evaluations really with relationships in mind, evaluations rather than, you know, simply symptom management. And that means also the relationship I'm having with the client, because a lot of times people will go in, talk to somebody who's a psychopharmacologist, get a checklist, and you don't really understand the implications of what the medications are doing on a, for a person in bigger aspects of their life. So it's a way of doing sort of medication interventions that actually is, I think, kind of more holistic and more supportive of the person as a whole.
Okay. And some of these exercises in the book that we can do for strengthening our neural pathways, do some of them involve other people as well?
They do, yeah. So one of the things, and I'll just give you an example, there are a handful of them that do involve other people, but for instance, with your mirror neuron system, you know, the idea of accurately reading people is so key, but I think most of us walk around with a whole set of assumptions about, you know, we might feel what the other person is feeling, but then we put our own meaning onto it.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you spent an afternoon with a friend or even a partner, and you just agreed that you would do what are called spot checks, and just periodically, you know, pause and read, say, okay, this is what I'm picking up from you, this is how I understand it, and really just check it for accuracy.
Mm. Interesting. Right? Yeah, definitely. Well, it's been an interesting hour with Dr. Amy Bangs. She's Director of Advanced Training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women. She's the co-author with Lee Ann Hirschman of Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. Thanks so much, Dr. Bangs.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Have a good afternoon.
You too.
Take care.
Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary, Michael Stock, with assistance on our studio phones. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. And Bonnie and I return Thursday with Linda Gassenheimer. We'll visit with All the Rage celebrity baker Dominique Ancel. He's famous for creating the ubiquitous cronut pastry, a blend of the croissant and the donut. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and important links at the Topical Currents Facebook page, plus discussion and photos. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. Mercy. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs.